Coming to you live.
Alive. Barely alive. Hello, everyone.
More alive than before.
Yes. So, some weeks we, like, don't have an excuse to not record. It's just, like, work and life and trying to figure out scheduling is so hard.
I think that's a valid excuse.
It is a valid excuse, but, like, legitimately, we were set to record last week. We were like all ready to go. And then I finally got COVID. And it was horrible.
How?
0 out of 10.
How was the vid?
Would not recommend.
No.
So not only did I have COVID, but it was also 90 plus degrees every day, the entire week in Boston. And as I have discussed in this podcast, I don't have air conditioning. So not only was I, like, ill from COVID, just, like, straight up dying, it was also really hot and terrible. And I passed out. I don't think that was due from the heat, though, because it was, like, in the night when it was cooled off. But
I mean, sure,
not
the heat
great.
Didn't help. I'm glad that you survived. Welcome to the club of the infected.
I know, that's like the most, I feel like I was so cool because I, like, made it for so long without getting it, and now I'm just like, whatever.
Do you have any idea of where you might have gotten it? Do we need to go hunt someone down for going out into the world infected?
I think I got it from going to the MFA here in Boston. Oh. So that's what I get for going to.
As long
to.
As it wasn't the crepe place, because
well, it could have been. But considering that, like, Evan got it a few days after me, I think that it was probably when I went out. So it was either I got it from a smoothie place or the MFA, or being on public transportation. So one of those.
Valid. Well, we are glad to have you back in the land of the living.
Okay. Yeah.
Everyone, COVID is still a thing. Wear a mask. And also, like, there are other sicknesses out there other than COVID as well. Monkeypox sounds terrifying. Be careful. The regular old cold is also a thing. Wash your hands. Stay home if you're sick.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a huge bummer being sick during the summer, because when you're sick, you want to have, like, soup and, like, hot tea and, like, be cuddled in a blanket. I could do none of those things when I was sick, so don't get sick this time of year.
That's a really interesting perspective, because I'm one of those people who's like, ooh, soup in the summer is great, or, like, ice cream in the winter. I like that. And so I had soup yesterday.
Yeah.
Might have,
well,
it
if
again
I had
today.
Air conditioning, I would probably be way more open to having soup. But yeah, this past week, I was like, nah, not happening. So I just ate applesauce and popsicles. So it was okay.
Well, that's nice. Anyway.
But, so aside from all that, we did get contacted by a listener. Bonnie Nitty reached out to us about the episode we did about Sabella Nitty and had a correction for us. So we had incorrectly, I don't even remember, was it me or you?
It was my case.
Okay. That we referred to her son as Steve and her son's name is Michael. So just throwing out that correction. So sorry.
Yeah.
For making that mistake.
Thanks for correcting us.
Absolutely. And if you have any corrections going forward, I'm not afraid to admit that I'm wrong about a lot of things. So feel free to let us know.
Yeah. Cool. Any other lively updates before you let us in on whatever this surprise case is?
No, that was it. That's all I've had going on.
Okay,
so,
cool.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Rachel.
And I'm Natalie. Welcome to Pink Collar, a true crime podcast focusing on crimes committed exclusively by women. Each week, we'll be bringing you a brand new case focusing on the psychology behind these crimes and advocating for early intervention.
Please subscribe on your preferred podcasting platform and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. For every review, we will donate a dollar to the National Center for Victims of Crime. This case is a little unconventional, but will sound familiar. Actually, so I'm trying to remember when this even happened. My life is now like pre-COVID and post-COVID, and it feels like the last week was like 5 years. But I saw this article. I believe it was on a BuzzFeed thing, or maybe it was through Reddit. I'm not 100% sure, but it was an article about this thing called the American Plan, which I had never heard of before. And I sent it to Natalie and I was like, we're doing an episode on this because it has to do with women and being locked up. And actually, too, is quite, you know, the themes of this country, you know, wanting to control women's bodies is very, very on par with what's, you know, not much has changed since the 1910s, we'll say. So today, like I said, I will be talking about the American Plan. So, Margaret Hennessy and her sister, in 1919 were walking to the meat market on February 25th. Margaret lived with her husband, H.J. Hennessy, who was a foreman at Standard Oil in Richmond, California. Margaret was recovering from influenza and was staying with her sister, who the press only identified as Ms. M. Bradditch. Is MRS, is that Mrs. or Ms.?
Mrs.
Mrs. Okay, just kidding. Mrs. It just doesn't make any sense. So what? Why is there an R? Mrs. Mrs.
Good. I'm going to Google this while you keep talking.
All right. Mrs. M. Bradditch. And you know what? Having recently been ill, I think it totally makes sense that she was going to stay with her sister and not relying on her husband to take care of her while she was sick. Because, Evan, I love you, but like, dang. Also, he was sick, so it was just not a great time. But I feel like women are more, like, caretakerly. So, like, okay. Anyway,
well, I have there. Information. So, yeah? Mrs. originated as a contraction of the honorific mistress. The feminine of Mr. or Master, which was originally applied to both married and unmarried women. So, yeah, it's just a shortened version of mistress.
Mistress, love it. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's ridiculous that women are like Mrs. or Ms. It's like, if we just call guys Mr., then why are we doing that for women? That just seems a little bit ridiculous. Anyway, moving forward. So Margaret and her sister were approached by Officer Ryan and other members of the Sacramento Morals Squad. The squad was brand new, so new in fact, that it had just formed that morning. And they had taken it upon themselves to start cleaning up the city. They wanted to eliminate vice and immorality. So what on earth were these two women doing on their lonesome? Where were their male chaperones? They must be criminals. So the police decided to place them under arrest as suspicious characters. Now, Margaret thought this had to be a misunderstanding. She explained to them that she was in town visiting her sister. She offered to show them her identification. She told them that her 6-year-old son was attending school in a local convent. And she said, if I'm arrested, there's going to be no one around to look after my child. But the officers didn't listen. Margaret said they paid no heed, but took my sister and I to the hospital. Margaret and her sister were taken to the city's isolation hospital, known as the Canary Cottage. Isolation hospitals, or fever hospitals, were hospitals for those suffering from infectious diseases like scarlet fever or smallpox or in this case, sexually transmitted infections. So while there, a doctor probed and examined the two women's genitalia. He was looking for STIs. Margaret would later tell the local newspaper, "At the hospital, I was forced to submit to an examination just as if I was one of the most degraded women in the world. I want to say I've never been so humiliated in my life. My reputation means something to me, and I'm going to defend it." So Margaret and her sister were not the only women arrested that day. The police also arrested a Mrs. M. Sodfried. Less than an hour later, they arrested Lena Roserine. Next, they arrested J.S. Smith, Miss Butterworth, and Miss R. Nichols. In total, there were 22 women that were arrested on that February 25th of 1919. So the examinations revealed that Margaret and her sister did not have any sexually transmitted infections, and they were released at 8 p.m. and had orders to appear in court the following morning. Margaret was enraged. She was ready to fight tooth and nail to defend her reputation, but luckily for her, the charges were dismissed. Margaret was, however, left traumatized after the arrest. She told the Sacramento Bee, "I dare not venture on the streets for fear I will be arrested again." Out of the 22 women, 16 were released later that day, but 6 were held overnight and were not allowed to have contact with anyone. In the end, only one woman tested positive for an STI. The Sacramento Bee stated, "In other words, out of 22 suspects subjected to an examination, the police were justified in arresting but one woman." And I beg to differ, because why are you that? No, not justified, even if someone has, you know, health conditions that they are dealing with.
Not your business.
Is that an arrestable offense? I think not. Hopefully the good staff at the Sacramento Bee has changed their tune since then. But unfortunately, these women's experiences were not out of the ordinary. From the 1910s to the 1950s, tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands, of American women were arrested and forcibly examined for STIs. This program, known as the American Plan, was modeled after similar programs in Europe, where authorities stalked suspicious women and used this as a reason for arresting them, testing them, and imprisoning them. During this time, there was a federal push to prevent soldiers and sailors from contracting STIs. Federal officers came to learn a huge number of men in the armed forces were infected with syphilis or gonorrhea. While these days syphilis and gonorrhea are treatable with the right medications, at the time it posed a threat to national security. Side effects of syphilis can include having rashes or sores. One might experience fever, swollen lymph nodes, headaches, weight loss, and muscle fatigue. Gonorrhea can cause painful urination, pelvic pain, and if untreated, can spread to your joints or other areas of your body. So understandably, I guess, people were concerned about these conditions spreading. So they passed a federal law banning sex work within a 5-mile moral zone of every military training camp. Which is confusing to me because it wasn't sex work already illegal? But maybe they were enforcing it? I don't know.
Yeah. Wait, what year was this?
1910s. So maybe not. I don't know. I should have looked that up.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like it would have been illegal, but maybe they just wanted to throw an extra law on there, or they were going to be like,
"Don't even
well, we're
dare.
Actually going to be enforcing it, you know, even for the guys." Wink, wink. But they learned that most of the soldiers and sailors were contracting the STIs in their hometowns, so they tried to expand the laws to cover the entire nation. But another wrench that was in their plans, they found that the men were contracting the infections from having casual sex, so not necessarily sex workers. So during this time, the blame was unfairly, I think, placed on sex workers. There was, you know, sexually transmitted infections going around, and they just wanted to find a person to pin that on, or a group of people, rather, to pin that on. because, you know, it's possible for anyone to contract a sexually transmitted infection. It doesn't primarily fall just to sex workers.
No,
so
it has to be from the unclean women.
Yes.
Like, duh. The men can't be also complicit in passing
around. Oh, yes, of course.
Disease.
The men had no part in this. They were completely innocent. It was those devil women. So that's who they decided to pin it on. And in 1918, federal officials wanted to push every state to pass a model law. This allowed officials to examine any person that was reasonably suspected of having an STI. And if someone tested positive for an STI, they could be held in detention for as long as it took to render that person non-infectious. The law was passed on July 9th, 1918, and was called the Chamberlain-Kahn Act, named for Senator... Oh, go ahead.
No, sorry, keep going.
Named it was for- named for Senator George Earl Chamberlain of Oregon and Representative Julius Kahn of California.
So did they have actual STI tests, or was it... I mean, the examination you described earlier was a visual one, which, I mean, it doesn't have to be visible for you to have something. Think is how most people tend to spread it, is like they weren't bothered down there, therefore mm-hmm. they proceeded business as usual. So, like, do you know what the tests were?
That is a good question. Let's see. According to this, In 1910, the German bacteriologist August Wassermann came with the first serologic test for syphilis. So, it's possible, but no, you bring up, I was refreshing my memory a little bit on sexually transmitted infections, and I believe, it's syphilis, that there's like the latency stage where, like you said, you can be carrying the condition and you can be contagious. Yeah, it's syphilis. So there's the primary stage where you may have sores, secondary stage where you might have skin rashes or sores in your mouth, latent stage where there's no visible signs or symptoms, but without treatment you can continue to have it exist in your body for years. So that's a good question. I'm not 100% sure if they had a physical test that they did or if they just looked for people who had current signs, if there were sores or just like anything physical present. I'm not sure, but that's a fair point to bring up, that like, was it even fair? It's possible that there could be someone who is contributing to spreading the infection that may not have symptoms themselves. So was this even an effective way to, prevent spreading? I don't know. Seems like they weren't necessarily, you know, encouraging people to practice safe sex. Condoms back in the 1910s? When were condoms invented?
Yeah, I think condoms have been around for a while. Because, like, they would use, like, lamb intestines.
Okay, that sounds disgusting.
Maybe
though.
I'm making that up.
That's totally right, but are those, you know, effective in preventing sexually transmitted infections? Not 100% sure. But, you know, If they really wanted to slow the spread of sexually transmitted infections, then the way to do that is to provide education to people. The treatments that they had, which I will talk about in a bit, and which we've talked about in previous episodes, are not pleasant. So that would be the other way, is making sure that there's treatment available to people, and encouraging methods of safe sex. But nope, instead blame the evil devil women and lock her up, as they say. So George and Julius, great guys, they made this act. And while the law was technically gender neutral, they pretty much only used it to regulate women. So no
surprise
there. If a woman tested positive for an STI, they were locked away in a penal institution without due process. Sometimes they were detained for a few days, but it could be up to months. Of course, many of the records from the institutions have been lost or destroyed, so it's not like there's an hugely accurate representation of what exactly was happening, but according to what they did have, they would provide treatment for the STIs, which at this time included being injected with mercury or forced to ingest arsenic-based drugs. Also, women, you know, I believe whether or not they even had an STI, if they did not behave in a ladylike manner, they could be punished while they were incarcerated by being doused in cold water, being beaten, or being thrown into solitary confinement. In some cases, women were forcibly sterilized, and sometimes they wouldn't even tell women that they were sterilizing them. But as this law started to gain traction, it faced pushback from higher-up members of the government. People started to point out that these laws were unconstitutional, and governors in many states refused to pass these laws, stating it's not up to the government to police women's bodies. Just kidding, they did not do that.
Sorry.
I sounded convincing though, didn't I?
Yeah, I was like, okay, I literally started looking to see if I disconnected from you.
I was waiting for you to be like, wow, that's great. And then I'd be like, just kidding.
I was like, uh-huh, like what happened? Like how did we end up where we are?
So, the New York mayor, I should have looked up how to pronounce this, Fiorello LaGuardia, which I believe is...
like the airport.
Airport guy.
Yeah.
He gave a speech saying these laws were great, and the then California governor, Earl Warren, personally took charge of the enforcement of this law in his state. The Attorney General for the United States sent a letter out in 1918 to every U.S. attorney in the country saying, don't worry, this law is totally constitutional. He also sent letters to every U.S. attorney letting them know not to interfere with the enforcement of these laws. And perhaps, most disappointing of all, the American Civil Liberties Union declined to challenge the American plan. Actually, not only did they fail to oppose it, the founder, Roger Baldwin, actually encouraged the local branches to cooperate with law enforcement when it came to these laws. So, I guess ACLU can't beat winners on every single one of them, but the law was generally well received. People were not fans of STIs, and sex workers were an easy scapegoat during this time. So in 1921, every state in the Union and hundreds of municipalities had some sort of model law statute in their books. The laws only required there to be a reasonable suspicion to be justified in arresting a woman, and that could mean pretty much anything. They could be arrested for being at a restaurant alone, or for changing jobs, or for being with a man, or walking down the street. The abusive law was not shockingly also abused. Women were sometimes arrested if they refused to have sex with police or health officers. And in the 1940s, San Francisco police officers used the law as a threat if women did not give in to their sexual demands, threatening to have them vag or vaginally examined.
Daniel Holt's law would have fit in really well
back then. So, also, the law was used to target women of color and immigrant women who were subjected to a higher degree of abuse if they were arrested. And these laws, you know, continued to be enforced and finally were ended around the 1970s amid the rise of the civil rights movement, the women's liberation movement, and the sex workers' rights movement. They lasted for a long time, a half century, but few people have ever heard of it, which I had never heard of this happening. Natalie, had you ever heard of this happening?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, so that was kind of shocking. I mean, was it really shocking to me? I guess that in the history of America that they have done this to people before.
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of like, oh, okay. Par for the course.
Yeah. Yeah. This, given that, like, the Tuskegee syphilis study happened and also was something that I didn't know about until way later in life, I guess, you know, they don't really emphasize teaching us this stuff in American history in high school or college. You know, they kind of tend to brush those things under the rug a little bit. So I guess maybe I wasn't surprised. But the fact that I had never heard of it ever is totally crazy. So I just wanted, the article that I got this from was from history.com. Really great, really thorough article. But even so, there are some laws on the book even today, and public health statutes that allow states to examine reasonably suspected people and isolate the infected ones. I don't think it is used as often. It does make me think, though, that we did in our ethics course and as a licensed therapist. So we are mandated reporters and are required to report certain things. And I believe in some states, one of those things that you are mandated to report is if you have a patient who is positive for HIV, and if they say that they are having unprotected sex and not informing their partners that they have HIV, I believe you're required to report that to the local health department.
Is that interesting? Is HIV the only, I guess, STD, STI mm-hmm. that you have to report for?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, we actually did have, yeah, we had different, like, ethics things that we had to run through, which I'm sure, I don't know, are you taking any ethics courses, or have you taken any ethics courses yet?
I'm supposed to someday.
Sure. Yeah, it was something that came up. Like, I remember there being quiz questions or something. Like, if someone has HIV or AIDS and they have a caretaker who is coming into contact with their blood for whatever reason, but they have not disclosed that they have HIV or AIDS to this caretaker, is that something that you report? So it is something that exists, I think, at least to a much lesser degree today. It's an interesting ethical area, and whether or not mental health providers or doctors even should be, you know what, I don't know. Maybe I don't want to say any more on that.
Now, but I'm just left to wonder what your thought was.
It's,
you could say, I it mean, off. You could, we could say it after.
If you're not no, thinking. It's not even, you know, on the one hand, I think that we should respect people's you know, right to privacy, but part of being a mandated reporter is to you know, protect the safety of the person that you're counseling and others. So which, to even compare it to this also seems ridiculous, but if your client or patient informs you that they are thinking of physically harming someone else, if they're thinking of seriously harming or ending someone's life, you are required to get in contact with that specific person and inform them. So in terms of passing along a sexually transmitted infection, while there have been lots of treatments that have come along, it's no longer necessarily a death sentence for people. I think it's important to consider the stigma of that has surrounded HIV and AIDS for a very long time, and how people in the LGBTQ plus community have been very unfairly targeted and been on the end of that stigma. But at the same time, it's not something that is curable yet. So I think if someone is knowingly, if I were someone's partner, I would like to be aware of that. And two, these days there are steps that can be taken. You can get PrEP. There are ways to prevent or really lower the chance that you might spread the infection. So I think that I'm for having to inform, but I could understand where it might be controversial.
Cool. I hear you. I feel like I have no strong opinion.
Yeah. But first and foremost, I would want people just to engage in safe sex and inform, you know, have conversations with people beforehand about what that looks like for you and what that might entail, and make it so it doesn't even get to the point where a healthcare provider is having to make any calls or inform anyone.
Yeah.
Just be a good human. Everybody.
Be a good person. Be a bro.
No, be a girl.
Be a decent human being, I guess.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, it was a little short one, but like shocking, but honestly kind of perfect considering half my brain is like mush due to COVID.
I hear that. I have a sore throat, so let's wrap this up. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Our music is the track Wasteland by Joseph McDade. His Patreon and our podcast sources will be linked in the podcast description below. Any mistakes are entirely our own, so check out our wonderful sources for the most accurate information about these cases.
We talk about some tough subject matter on our show. If you or someone you love is in need of support, please reach out to the Crisis Text Line by texting HOME to 741741. They are available 24/7 and will connect you with a trained crisis counselor.
You can also reach the National Domestic Violence Hotline by calling 1-800-799-7233. Thank you so much for listening to our show. Join us next week for another episode of
Pink Collar, a true crime podcast.